Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The United States provides a really diverse mix of products to Japan.
Japanese consumers want to buy U.S. goods. Brian Brewster, Foreign Ag Service.
Japan has a really well-developed food, retail, restaurant market, and the population there really demands high-quality, high-value agriculture and food products. So right now, we have a mix of products that ranges from corn, soybean, wheat, to high-value beef, veal, pork, and poultry products. We're also seeing that there's a real demand for processed products, so processed fruits, craft beers, distilled spirits, consumer-oriented products. Those are some of the things that we're looking at. Additionally, one of the things that we want to highlight are tree nuts, dairy products, particularly cheese, condiments, sauces, and other prepared products as well.
This is Agriculture Today.
I do think we are engaging with urgency on this issue.
Talking about Mexico's ban on GMO corn, Alexis Taylor, Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Affairs, USDA.
We certainly appreciate the potential impact that the proposed decree could have on our corn growers here in the United States, but much broader than that, fundamentally our trading system globally, but also within the USMCA, is built upon science-based policies. And the challenge to that is greatly concerning. I have heard from specialty crop producers, livestock producers, all with the concern of Mexico with this decree moving away from that fundamental principle. I, on my third week on the job, and Ambassador McCaleb's second week on the job, we traveled jointly to Mexico to, again, engage with our counterparts there, highlight our concerns, highlight that this is a fundamental principle from the United States on what a global trading system is built upon, and not something that we can walk away from or negotiate away from. We continue to have those conversations with our Mexican counterparts, and we're reserving the right of all the all the rights awarded to us under USMCA, and we will continue to ensure that our trade that has been granted, trade access that has been granted to us within USMCA, is lived up to by all of our trading partners, and look forward to working with you in this committee on this very important issue, because it is a fundamentally critical question that we are answering here.
She tells members of the Senate Ag Committee that it's not yet time to give up on it.
We're still, I think, productively engaging with Mexico. We have been very clear that the USMCA gives us a process to go down if we cannot find resolution on this issue, and that we reserve all of those rights. But at least today, we are still productively engaging and hope to find a resolution that doesn't disrupt trade, impact our producers, and ultimately impact negatively Mexican livestock producers who are dependent on this product as well.
But when it comes to trade, it's not just GMO corn. Ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee from Arkansas, Dr. John Bozeman.
Undersecretary Taylor, rice and wheat farmers in Arkansas, rice wheat farmers throughout the country, are seriously impacted by India's blatant WTO violations. Can you tell us a little bit about what you all are doing in your partnership with Ambassador McCaleb, how you're able to take some steps to hold India accountable? Is there anything that we as a committee or as a Congress can do to be helpful in that regard? How can we make sure that this egregious over-subsidization, and those words aren't too strong, I think everybody agrees with that, how can we hold them accountable?
We continue to engage India in multilateral forums on this issue, raising questions within the WTO, and working on, in years past, counter notifications to bring out really what we view as the truth behind their subsidization policy here. I have been engaging with my team since I've been at USDA on this topic, as I committed to you I would. And I think, you know, while we do have grave concerns, and it is one that we are looking at multiple approaches to try and address within, again, the multilateral forum to try and bring some resolution and certainty to our rice and wheat producers who are seeing impact from the subsidies.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
First of all, a supplemental coverage option. You can only do that if you don't have ART coverage.
Jenny Ift is a Kansas State Ag Policy Specialist, is talking about that SCO coverage.
And what that's going to do, it's going to take your underlying multi-peril policy, whether it's yield or revenue protection, up to an 86% coverage level. But any payouts on that higher coverage level are going to be based off of county level yields, not your own yields. The other high level coverage policy, again, if you are looking at SCO, it does make sense to look at both of these at the same time. So the enhanced coverage option, that can be used with either PLC or ARC, so it is a little bit more flexible. And it's going to take a producer with an underlying revenue or yield policy from 86% to 90%, or from 86% to 95%. Again, there's the county level yield trigger.
So now we know what SCO is, but who can use SCO?
Anybody who has an underlying policy can use them. We've seen SCO grow since 2015, but both for SCO and ECO, they're still, for row crops, they're still under 5% of acres. You do have producers using them across the state. There are some regional patterns for corn, wheat, and sorghum. You see more producers using them in the western Kansas, more soybean producers in eastern Kansas, and to some degrees, these follow production patterns, but they are being widely used. I would also say for crop insurance for 2022 and a devastating droughts across most of the state, we're seeing that in crop insurance loss ratios. So the indemnities that people are receiving relative to the premiums they paid. And for the state as a whole, for corn and grain sorghum, the indemnities are around four times as much as producers paid into the program. And those indemnities can be really useful in managing the drought. So that goes to say that any producers who had ECO or SCO in 2020 are very likely to see, especially if they were in a drought area, very likely to receive large payouts or their full liability or full guarantee for those policies. That data is not available yet. And this is another important consideration. So producers that use ECO or SCO, indemnities aren't calculated until the USDA estimates county level yield. So it's going to be several months after you'd receive an indemnity for your underlying policy.
But some question why SCO is triggered at the county level.
There's two reasons why having that county-based yield trigger is an important part of making these products available. First of all, it keeps the cost down. I know these products may seem expensive. They are going to increase your premium. However, if that guarantee was at the farm level, they would be much more expensive. There actually are some private products available as well that aren't subsidized where you can insure that farm-level risk at higher levels. The second reason is something economists call moral hazard, and this is an issue for all types of insurance, whether it's cars or crops. And the idea here, what moral insurance basically means, if you insure everything, whether that's all of your crop or all of your car, some people might not take care of it. So again, whether it's driving safely or, you know, make enough investments to get good crop yields. Now, I believe that most farmers are going to do the best for their farm no matter what. However, it could only take a few to cause problems for the entire program. And again, this isn't just a crop insurance issue. This is an insurance issue in general.
That's Jenny Ift, a Kansas State University Ag Policy Specialist, talking about SCO coverage. And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
And it pains me at times when we have this conversation about food and agriculture in this country that seeks to pit one aspect of agriculture against the other or seeks to demonize certain aspects of agriculture. That's not where I see us headed.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack explaining why agriculture needs a united front.
I see us headed towards a transformed food system that recognizes the contribution of diverse forms of agriculture, that recognizes the importance of food production to our very being, that recognizes the importance of how it can, in fact, and should link rural and urban centers. There's no reason why you can't have a farm in a city. You ought to have a farm in a city because it does connect people to their food system. There's no sense why we can't collectively work together to make sure that healthy foods are more accessible to more people, because it's in our collective best interest for that to happen. If we can save folks from chronic disease, if we can save folks from having to have dialysis, that's going to save not just them, it's going to save all of us. And so this work is just incredibly important that we all row and work in the same direction, because I think there's unlimited possibilities and potential for a transformation of our system so that indeed we do have a sustainable agriculture that gets to net zero. We do have a way in which farmers can see that they can make a living and pass it on to the next generation. We do have expanded access to healthy choices for everybody, not just the fortunate few that can afford to go to some of the higher-end grocery stores, but to everybody having that access, that we do have a food bank and food pantry system that has access to the same level of delicious foods that we can get, so that folks don't feel as they've been left out or left behind. That's what this is all about. That's what this transformed system and the investments we make today and the investments we've made over the last year, that's the goal here, is to have that kind of system where we all can take pride in that system. So I'm looking forward to working with all of the folks who are watching this today and all the folks in the food and agriculture industry to make this transformation happen, because I think it's in the best interest of our country. And I think, frankly, agriculture can not only lead the way from an environmental perspective and an economic sustainability perspective, but I do believe, as I think Haley may have mentioned, that it is a way in which we can reconnect with one another, a way in which we can rediscover community in this country, to break down this divisiveness that is making it so difficult for us to accept and deal with some of the other big challenges we face as a country. So I hope you all see the magnitude and the importance of this work, and that we work together to make it happen.
And if we're talking about a transformed food system, we also have to look at the future workforce.
Now, there are two aspects of capacity when we speak of capacity in a transformed food system. There's obviously the physical infrastructure that's necessary to produce the food, but there's also the people that are needed to be trained and experienced to do the work. Both aspects require investment. Now, while our country waits for the United States Senate to pass the Farm Worker Modernization Act, USDA intends to move forward to help build a talented workforce. And this is one of a number of initiatives that we'll be announcing in the very near future. As part of the initial investment in a transformed food system, we're going to make $40 million available to work with land-grant universities, community colleges, and minority-serving institutions to support workforce development, starting with the meat and poultry industry. This is a first step in an effort to rebuild the workforce for agriculture.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Chair Stabenow and I have been advocates for a long time with local food, and proud to have played a role in creating the LAMP program, the Local Agriculture Market Program. The last Farm Bill was a great step towards strengthening local and regional food systems.
Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown is a member of the Senate Ag Committee.
But more must be done. It's why Senator Thune and I are introducing the Strengthening Local Processing Act. Our bill is about expanding local meat and poultry processing infrastructure. It's critical for going to lower prices and address corporate consolidation, the ever-encroaching corporate consolidation in the meat industry, as we've seen in far too many places in agriculture and our economy overall. I'm working on a bill to strengthen LAMP support, increased USDA procurement from local producers. I've heard concerns from organizations in Ohio under Secretary Moffitt about the application process. The program can be too difficult to access for lower, let's just say, lower resourced and underserved communities. I know we can fix that. I need your help. I know we can count on you to do that. Give us some thoughts on how we will work together on this.
During a recent Senate Ag Committee hearing, Jenny Moffitt, Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, answered.
At the height of the pandemic, at the early stages of the pandemic, we saw how important local and regional supply chains are. And the LAMP program particularly is valuable in building those bridges and building the connections and the capacity for both communities, for buyers in those communities, as well as farmers and producers in the communities, to really foster those relationships so that we can get more product grown locally, produced locally into the local food system as well, enhancing our supply chains and really giving more choice for farmers to access more markets, as well as more choice for consumers to be able to buy from local farmers as well. Regarding your question on accessibility of the LAMP programs and the application process, I really want to thank you for that question and for the leadership in the 2018 Farm Bill directing the Agricultural Marketing Services to work on this. Agricultural Marketing Services has done a few different things. We have worked directly with producers as well as resources at universities to create things like guidebooks to access to the program. We also answer technical questions. We open office hours and answer questions for people who are potential applicants. I'm really proud to say that as we get toward the next round, the 2023 round of the LAMP grants, we will be adding a new component, a much more streamlined component for organizations, for producers, for those who are interested in applying for the LAMP grants to be able to have much more easier access and a streamlined application process.
But there's not enough money for the MAP and FMD programs. Alexis Taylor is Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Affairs.
The market development programs that we have, a suite of market access, the MAP program is the largest. We've received $200 million in funding for that program. I would say it's highly oversubscribed. With our industry partners, they submit proposals to do export market development activities within the frame of that program. And on average, with them self-regulating what they're submitting, we are getting $300 million at least of project proposals. And so I think there's a large need there because these dollars are so effective and important to developing, to maintaining those markets, and to diversifying away from the People's Republic of China and some of the challenges that we've seen with them being our largest trading partner. These are also, I think, an important note when talking about these market development programs is they're highly highly leveraged. So for every $1 that federal funding that is being utilized, somewhere between $2.30 and $2.40 of industry funds are going to match those resources. And so while the federal government is invested, our industry is invested in these markets and successes there as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The price volatility for crop insurance is a very important parameter for setting premiums on revenue crop insurance products.
University of Illinois ag economist Gary Schnittke.
And that includes revenue protection, RP, the most popular product, as well as the other combo product, RP with HPE. Supplemental coverage option, enhanced coverage option also use the volatility in setting premiums, as well as the area revenue plans. The price volatility is a measure of uncertainty in prices. It gives us a feel for how wide the distribution of prices can be. The December contract is used for that for corn in Midwest states, so we're measuring the volatility of the December contract. The November contract is used for soybeans in Midwest states. Higher volatilities, as they go up, that means that there are more uncertainty about prices in the future. And because there's more uncertainty, we can have probability of lower prices increasing, and as a result, premiums on crop insurance products increase as the price volatility increases. The price volatility is calculated by RMA, Risk Management Agency, the agency that oversees federal crop insurance product, and they use a Black-Scholes model to calculate those volatilities. A Black-Scholes model is an option pricing model, so we're using option prices to calculate the volatilities, which are implied by premiums on put and call options. RMA gets these volatilities from barcharts.com, and it gets those for the last 5 days of February for corn and soybeans in the Midwest states. So the estimate of the volatility is based on the last 5 days of February. Those 5 days are averaged and then adjusted to account for the fact that prices are used in October rather than at the expiration of the respective future price contracts. Volatilities can vary across years, and we have had, since 2011, a low of 0.15 volatility for corn, and that happened in 2018, 2019, and 2020, to a high of 0.29 in 2011. In 2022, we had a 0.23 volatility. Again, those volatilities have a large impact on crop insurance premiums. And here is an example of those for Champaign County in 2023. These are for enterprise units and use a 595 projected price. A 0.23 volatility has a $34.82 premium. Again, that's for an enterprise unit. And that premium can go up to $38.09 for a 0.25 volatility, all the way up to $45 for a 0.28 volatility. Conversely, the premium goes down if we have lower volatilities. Soybean volatilities have also shown variability from 0.12 in 2019 and 2020 up to 0.23 in 2011. The 2022 volatility was 0.19. A 0.19 volatility in Champaign County for enterprise units would have a $13.53 premium. We lower that volatility to 0.15, the premium would be $9.96. Again, those volatilities are set in the last 5 days of February, and hence that period is crucial and critical for determining the premiums on crop insurance products.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There's several studies out there, and herds we deal with, it kind of shows the same thing, is that we see a higher incidence in male calves.
Craig Henselchek is a veterinarian at Kansas State University on who might be at risk for BRD.
And that's true in other species. It looks like other species of males are more predisposed to respiratory disease. Calves from two-year-old dams, they seem to be at a higher risk. And that kind of makes sense because the two-year-olds, the heifers, their colostrum quality is not going to be as good as a cow. They may lack the mothering ability, or they may go through a dystocia. We know that calves that experience dystocia, their immune systems aren't going to function as well. Other risk factors are larger herds. And they, like I said, we know that that's true for probably all our diseases. One of the big risk factors are herds that bring in calves from outside sources. So we're talking about herds that bring in calves that may have a different strain of these pathogens or maybe a high load of these pathogens. Those herds are at a much higher risk of this disease than others. We mentioned ester synchronization. And then other thing is herds that experience a diarrhea problem in neonatal calves, they're typically going to be at a higher risk of having respiratory disease later on. And that could have to do with management. It could have to do with immune system and all kinds of things. So those are what we think are the major risk factors for this disease in herds.
So how can you determine a virus and what to do?
It's the same organism in post-weaning BRD. It's a Mannheimia, the Pasteurella, the bacteria. Of the viruses, we typically see BRSV and now corona. For us, corona is the primary virus that we isolate out of these outbreaks. And I know producers know that corona is a major player in neonatal scours. This is a different corona genetically. And there's controversy out there. Is this corona actually a pathogen for respiratory disease or not? In the diagnostic lab at K-State, we believe it is. We have to know what those organisms are first before we can design any type of program. Well, if they have it in their own herd, the first thing they need to do is find out what the predominant organisms are. So if they're unfortunate enough to have any deads, then for sure have them necropsied, have some diagnostics completed on them. But there's some really good tests that can be completed on live calves by taking nasal swabs and just seeing what bacteria, what viruses actually are there in the upper respiratory tract. And then from there, as always, they need to follow their veterinarian's advice on what treatment and what prevention program to be on. If they're not vaccinating for whatever predominant organism they find in their outbreak, then it's not going to help them this year. But for next year, they probably should add that to their vaccine program. And then the other thing is timing. Sometimes we need to time our vaccination in the calves to better match when we expect the outbreak. And some herds have changed that to maybe later on in the pasture season. That's when they vaccinate, and that seems to help. Some of the most successful things that we've seen in herds that have actually prevented this is instead of ester synchronization, bringing everybody in the same pen, or even processing, bringing everybody in the same pen, they'll work them in small groups. And so it reduces the concentration of the organisms the calves are exposed to, and that seems to help a lot. The vaccination thing is really frustrating. There is no corona vaccine for respiratory disease, and so producers are trying to use a scour vaccine to to help prevent the respiratory corona. Some are going to autogenous vaccines. Those things are just hit and miss. But those management things seem to help a bunch if we're talking about synchronization and processing.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It will be the 58th USDA Conservation Reserve Program general sign-up, scheduled to start on February 27th, one of several CRP sign-ups this year. As Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau says, whether it's
general CRP or grasslands, it's never too early to start planning and start getting together your offer, and our county offices are always willing to help producers get ahead of the game.
Currently, 23 million acres are enrolled in CRP, with almost 2 million set to expire this year. General CRP sign-up concludes on April 7th. Dates will soon be announced for grassland CRP enrollment, while continuous CRP allows for year-round sign-up. More details about CRP are available through local FSA service centers or online at www.fsa.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.